Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
March 1st, 2017, episode number 104, Philly Recap. Hi, everyone. Thanks for stopping by. My name is Kevin England, in case you didn't know that. And welcome to our little corner of the world, quaint Hunterdon County in central New Jersey. It's been unseasonably warm off and on here. And as I speak, it's 54 degrees outside at 4 a.m., which is simply just, it doesn't make sense for New Jersey this time of year. It's supposed to be 20 degrees outside, but we have what appears to be a tropical wave coming up into the area with heavy rains to our south yesterday and forecasts for severe thunderstorms this morning and afternoon. I guess we'll see how the day goes, but it's been really interesting watching the weather this early, well, late winter, early spring. Another interesting thing is I've been able to look in on the bees, and today I'll get to see how they're doing during that storm. I'm testing a wireless camera out in the bee yard that picks up when the bees are flying, and I can look in on them live, which is a lot of fun. Gives me a bit of enjoyment during the day to dial up the bees and see how they're doing. But okay, I'm already rambling. Enough of that. Let's tell you what I have in store. I decided with this episode to deviate a touch from our standard routine and dedicate the entire effort to providing some coverage, as promised, to the Philly Beekeeper Symposium that I attended on February 4th. I think I mentioned that as far as beekeeper sessions go, this was hands down the best day of beekeeping education that I sat in ever. And that's saying a lot. I've seen some pretty big heavy hitters. Every speaker brought their A game, and I was sitting forward all day and taking scrupulous notes, and my intention is to give you the highlights of the day here today and pass along the messages from each of the speakers. The episode's going to consist of a number of segments, and each segment will be a recap of the speaker's topic along with any insights that I might share along the way or musings that I had about the particular topic. On a programming note, before we get started, I'll share that this will be one of the few episodes where I'm going to dive right in and forego the local hive report. You might have noticed that the release of this episode is a few days behind. Sorry for that. I ended up heading to Maryland this past weekend with my older brother on an impromptu trip to see my father, and we watched the Daytona 500 together. And I left in the middle of the day on Saturday on short notice and didn't get home till real late on Sunday, and there was no time to produce. I did record another podcast this past weekend, but because of the trip, I didn't get to produce it. So as a concession for not getting it out, I'll produce it and post it this upcoming weekend. But I thought I'd record this one in lieu, because I wanted to get this messaging out. So this week and next week, you'll see 104 and number 105 released back-to-back. 105's a smidge of an alternate production, as it's a sidebar on thoughts of natural beekeeping, and specifically biodynamic beekeeping, and it has a local hive report in there. We'll return to our regularly scheduled program when we come back for episode 106 on 312. Okay, blah, 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 let's get going. Segment number one, I want to talk about the talk given by Karen Rakaseka. She's the PA state apiarist. First topic she talked about, and was a crowd favorite, was antibiotics. A law went into place in January in the United States about antibiotics. And as it applies, it does include beekeeping. And specifically, the one thing I always hear people talking about is terramycin. So at the core of this goal was the government was trying to keep antibiotics out of our food. And therefore, any time they're to be applied, you have to have a prescription in order to get the medications. And a veterinarian needs to be involved in it. So I know I touched on this a bit in the past, but I'll just go over it again and reinforce with more detail since I have the notes in front of me. The difficulty is the states are scrambling to try and figure out how to do this because, as noted, the veterinarians have no idea about bees. And therefore, they're supposed to come out and make a diagnosis, my word. But fundamentally, they're supposed to come out and tell you whether you have a problem and then decide whether you need to have medication or not. And some of it is predicated on the fact of how it's applied. It can be combined with powdered sugar and it's a prescription, not a veterinary feed. Or it can be mixed in. So the distinction is whether it's placed in or placed on. And those descriptions determine whether it's a prescription or a veterinary feed, which are handled differently. Prescriptions require a veterinarian to issue a written statement authorizing its use. So the gist of this is they're trying to figure this out, and they're trying to work with veterinarians and get interpretations. Yes, the law is out there, but how it's being applied and how it's to be governed. The state apiarists are seeing this as a problem for beekeepers and need to start working with veterinarians. Somebody's got to do it. And I know that some bee clubs are getting involved in this as they see fit on behalf of commercial interests. And of course, the state apiarists serve commercial interests, so everybody's trying to figure this out. I had a sidebar with Tim Schuler about this at the state meeting in New Jersey, and he's in the same boat. He was interested in what Karen had to say, and it's the same thing. New Jersey is trying to work this out and figure it out. So I think it would be interesting to know if any of the states have this figured out. If you're in a place where the state has it figured out and they've issued guidelines, it would probably be really helpful for all the other states if somebody else is ahead of the curve. But it sounds to me as if the realization of this thing kicked in January, and people are now trying to deal with the consequence of how to execute it. And this was February 4th, and they were still working on the game plan for it. I don't suggest, and I know that some people have suggested this on the side, is to hoard some of these things like terramycin that people had in their stores. But again, I'm not sure that you're going to get any sound advice yet because it sounds like everything is being worked out. So one other side note on this has to do with honey sales. She mentioned that honey processing that takes place on a farm or a place where some of these antibiotics could be impacted in the future with new rules. My guess is that's leading to something like this honey was processed at a place where antibiotics was used or something like that, but I'm not sure. So I would say that, thinking out loud, they need to get in order here. The law went in place in January and the bees are dormant right now, so to speak, but the clock is ticking and they need to get their act together and have instructions in the support network for this. And what I understand is certain universities and other things are also kind of looking at this and seeing if they can come out and support what's supposed to happen. So one other thing that she mentioned that I made notes on is that you could buy a test from Mann Lake that determines whether or not you have American fowl brood. It's a 3.5-minute test, and this is that note that bears repeating again of she was discussing whether people who had American fowl brood or suspected should bring their frames to a vet, and the answer is no. Do not transport your frames. Have someone come to you. So we were in Pennsylvania, and as the Pennsylvania state apiarist, there was a lot of questions that came from the audience of how this was going to get handled for them, as you would suspect, and a number of other Pennsylvania topics that I don't know that I'm going to pass along here. But one thing that came up was, like last year, she mentioned that they're still on the lookout for tropilalops, and apparently all state apiarists are under command to take a look for this. And the question came from the audience about how would you even know what it looks like. And the discussion centered on a new tool that's available out there called BeMite ID. I'm going to give you an address for this, but this is bee-associated mite genre of the world. And you can identify mites that harm important pollinating bees worldwide. The USDA, University of Michigan, and a group called Lucid, L-U-C-I-D, have come together to create a tool at a website that is idtools.org/id/mites/bee-mites, and I'll put a note to that in the show notes. Here you can get fact sheets about them, get a key to try and identify them. There's quick references, a glossary, a gallery, and other tools. So that's an interesting thing to take a look at. And at some point, I'll see if I can go back and do a feature on that if it bears looking at. I didn't get a chance to dig in, but I did want to pass along that. So it's BeMite ID. I'm guessing if you search somewhere, you'll find that. And it's idtools/id/mites/bee-mites, BEEMITES, all one word. As you might imagine, by the way, there is something on Varroa there that you can read with a bunch of different pictures and so on. So you can check that out. So Karen got things started. She was kind of the warm-up act. And now what I'll do is move to segment number two. The segment number two, The Road to Mite Check. This was Rebecca Masterman from the University of Minnesota. Wow. What an ambitious program they have. I'm so impressed by where they have grown and what they're doing. And they're just, they have, dare I say, a very young and millennial style approach to the way that they're doing things. And I enjoy their program and think a lot of universities could model over what they're doing. So let me go ahead and talk a little bit about what she covered. And she rattled off a whole bunch of things that they're working on from a bee program standpoint. They have the Bee Squad, which are doing different programs where they go out and educate and do research. And to support them, they have a number of side initiatives. One is they have a relationship to train veterans to be beekeepers. There's a lot of artists out there that have the millennial mindset to be one with nature and do so on, but maybe they, you know, not just artists, a lot of people want to do something for the bees, but they don't want to keep bees. In this case, they're exploiting the interest in the artist community to save the bees and taking advantage of their unique skills to do messaging and use them for communication and outreach. That's a really unique and interesting way of approaching things. And some of the programs that they have are really cool that she showed through the slide deck. They have pollinator ambassadors, and they're doing presentations to high schoolers to do outreach. And they do 1 to 3 events a week on that. So they're putting their money where their mouth is that they're doing outreach. And I love the fact that they're going after the younger population because, as you walk around bee meetings, no dig against beekeepers, right? But everybody's old. I feel like a young guy and I feel old. I'm an old man, but I think that's amazing. And I love, you know, we have a couple younger folks. Hey, you're younger. You know, we have a couple teenagers and 20-year-old segment in our club, and I just love their energy. They have a unique approach to life, and we need to do more and more of that. So it's great that they're going there. They have something called Hive to Bottle. This is a really big program, it looks like, for them, where, again, not everybody wants to keep bees, but people want to save the environment. So customers own the bees, but the Minnesota teams manage them. They have 98 apiaries being managed right now over a large geographical area. And this is a win-win for the university because, one, they have more bees out, and two, people are helping fund these things. It's not something that the university does, right? They charge to maintain these bees for the folks. And in return, the university is in bees all the time managing them. And they're seeing it from, this is an important aspect, not a yard at the university, right? Not some university lab or whatever. They're seeing real world environment and what people have in their yards or wherever they're keeping their bees. So I think that's really cool because they get the plight of the local beekeeper, but they can aggregate the information that they collect in this program back to the university and do a lot of information. So, you know, there's always this conversation about research in academia that they don't understand what goes on in the local beekeeper yard. This is a win-win in both solutions. That's a really cool approach on that. And then, of course, they maintain their mentoring yard and they make sure that their folks that are doing things understand what's going on. It sounds like a very progressive program, and I'm impressed by how far they've come from the time that I heard about them way back when I attended a American Beekeepers Federation, and they were starting to kick this off. I remember hearing about the Bee Squad a couple years ago at American Beekeepers Federation conference and kind of going, that's really weird. I don't understand what they're doing. But now that it's come full circle, it really is a very novel and interesting program that they have. So while she did the short intro on their program, which I took some notes on, she was really there to talk about the effect of mites. And she started out with talking about a well-known researcher, Marla Spivak, from her area and back to the 90s that you need to have a hygienic bee that did not require chemical treatments. And she went through a series of points that they've learned as they've been looking at the problem of mites. Specifically, nutrition is probably the thing that is going to help a hive better handle anything that's going at them. And if you look at the litany of things that bees are facing this year, insecticides, herbicides, fungicides, flowers that aren't there anymore, virus, pathogens, and of course varroa. The key here on her messaging is nutrition is the key to solving problems. And, you know, you've heard us say that a lot of times on the podcast, is nutrition will overcome a lot of things. So one of the things they noticed is that they are finding hives are dying in the first year. When started on foundation from packages. And what they're finding is, and this is unusual and a new aha moment for me, is 25 to 30% are seeing mite loads in that first year. Is there a concern for package and it might be a good idea, It might be a good idea to consider testing right away. So this was a notion that they're trying to teach their folks in their region is as soon as you get a package in, even as it's getting established, the first month, go do a mite check. You might say, brand new package. Producers do a good job. There shouldn't be mites. No, this is what they're saying. There's a change to this. Even first year packages, and I've made this recommendation a number of times. First year you have mites, or first year you have installed a package, you don't have to worry about mites. Generally, they don't build loads. It's always the second year when they had some mites that they get out of the gate and it ramps all summer and then you have a mite problem. But the first year, not so much. They're finding that's not true as they manage their hives. So what they're suggesting is train new beekeepers right out of the gate, first month and every month, do a mite check. And if you find a threshold, take care of your mites. And surprisingly, in the first year, even on a package, as you get through that first summer, you might find that you have a mite problem and you could keep your bees healthier by doing something to mitigate the problem. So, of course, the audience was like, well, how many mites and this and that? Some people are new. They don't understand. And she gave a good rule of thumb, which I thought was interesting. It's a way to think about it. One mite, you know you're in trouble, but keep going. This is when you take a sample and you find how many mites in the sample. 2 to 3, you should consider treating, but it's optional. Your choice, depending on what you think you have going on. if you get to 4, things are bad. And if it's 5 or higher in the sample, your hive is dead and you don't know it. So she almost got to the point where she was backing up to, if you have a mite, you should do something with it. And I won't put words in her mouth, but I've heard this repeatedly lately, is that it seems like, and I have a sidebar to come in the future on this, that it's not about the mite, it's about the viruses that they have. And the viruses that they're getting appear to be more impactful, my personal opinion. And even one mite is suggesting that the virus loads, which tend to be more virulent, is something we should be concerned about. So I won't go there. Don't take that as a... And I won't put words in her mouth. It said 2 to 3, consider treating. And my threshold has always been, if you have 3 or more, make sure you do something about it. But I want you to think of it this way. There's a new aspect of this. If you have 2 to 3 and the hive is weak, your hive's in trouble. If it's a booming hive in the middle of a flow and it's rolling up with population that can outpace or keep pace with the mites, 2 to 3 might be okay. But eventually when they get to the point where they drop off, then you're going to do something about it, monitor your mites. So I think there's 2 aspects to it. What's the threshold? And look at the hive. How healthy is it? How much can it tolerate anything? Now, people will have their slide rule, right? Some will say, as soon as I see a mite, I'm going to do something about it. I'm not going to wait. And others will say, I want the bees to ride it out. And if they can hang in there, I'm going to be good. You'll have to figure out where you are on the continuum. So as she progressed in her talk, she started discussing horizontal transmission of mites. There is a German study that she cited that showed mites were coming in from other hives and not necessarily from the reproduction cycle within the colony itself. And she discussed mitecheck.com, where they're trying to understand the mite population is not just at a hive level, but a region or area. And as I said, they were thinking they want to do monthly mite tests and then do analytics on those. She was joking, by the way, that people sent in mite samples from January and February, even though they were in colder climates, and she loved those people. I thought that was interesting. Her share of that was that they were learning something of interest in a time period where people don't report mites. And if everybody did it, it would be interesting to see how the data turned out. So I guess reporting mite levels is a hotbed in Michigan and Minnesota. And when you look at the data in those reports, you're going to see the people are reporting what they're getting. And one of the things about the bee squad that they've said is that they sell kits. I mean, people can have their own, but to make it easier for everybody, and in cooperation with Bee Informed Partnership, it's probably Bee Informed more so, you can buy a kit to do mite checks. And then you could send the samples back and people will log them. So at minimum, I guess the takeaway here is if you're in an area where maybe you have more virulent, yeah, strains, you know, and I suspect that is a problem that some places. And we've talked about this in the past on a podcast, but maybe you weren't here, so I'll repeat it for anybody who's new. Varroa is Varroa, but what they're doing is not necessarily the same. There's different levels of damage that certain ones are doing based on the Varroa itself and the different vectors that they're putting inside the hive. And specifically, I'm going to single out deformed wing virus. There's deformed wing virus A and B, and they really have different impacts to the bees, and it depends on which one is floating around your area, was my understanding. So I didn't do a great job on that. That's not my point. My point is that certain areas seem to be getting whacked harder than other areas. And it would be interesting to note the impact of hive monitoring and tie that all together and see if they can figure out with bigger data where the problems are, maybe. Maybe it'll unearth some finding on that aspect. But it's getting to the point, and I feel this is true, in my 2017, that monitoring of mites is not optional. It just has to be done. And when you find something, if you want your hives to survive, given how impactful varroa has been to colonies and what they're transmitting inside, you're going to have to do something about it. So in the part of this whole horizontal transmission of mites discussion, she noted something that I'm going to come back to Landy Simone and say. Landy indicated a long time ago, and it's always been locked in the recess of my mind, that she felt that mites were being transported around her neighborhood because she had treated and everything was good. And she came back in a late session and found mites all over the place. And she suspected that collapsing hives from other mites, mites from other hives that have collapsed are getting into her apiary. What was shown here was in densely populated areas with bees and beekeepers, varroa problems are everybody's problem. If a hive is within 1 mile of you and it has varroa and it's not being managed, those varroa are going to eventually end up in your apiary. And they'll end up in the one to the other side of your apiary. And everybody's all connected and they just keep going around and around and around. She showed a map of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the closeness of the hives, and indicated it's just one big apiary. And the only way you, as a beekeeper, can take care of everybody else's mites is reiterating testing, treat, and test after that. So the Philly Beekeeper Symposium is a natural symposium. So, of course, people were asking, well, what do I do? How do I do it naturally? Drone brood removal. Divides, brood interruption, requeening with genetic lines, and certain miticides are simpatico with the natural approach. And unfortunately, some people, I think, might have to consider using miticides, even though they didn't want to. Because the more aggressive people are about taking care of the mites, the healthier their bees are. That's just the fact that she was sharing. But again, she's going back to say nutrition is at the heartstring of everything that goes on. And we should be encouraging planting proper nutrition that the bees can have good nutrition all year long. Whatever we can do on those campaigns is really important. So she had one last topic on her pile, which was the bee cruise. If you go to beesquadtravel.com, you'll see that the University of Minnesota is scheduling a trip on October 8th through 15, 2017. You'll be sailing on the Liberty of the Seas. It's a 7-night Western Caribbean cruise. And it's a cruise ship, but it's all beekeepers. So it's the first one they're going to do. And through the trip, they do things like they're going to Cozumel and they're doing a bee-themed excursion. And they're going to Georgetown and they're doing a bee-themed excursion. And they're going to Jamaica and they're doing a bee-themed excursion. And they're having symposiums on the last couple days. So, wow, that's kind of cool. Going to have to dig into that a little bit and see if I have some vacation time. And yeah, got all kinds of trips planned this year. But not really. They're in my mind. So it sets sails from Galveston, Texas, which is a bit of a trouble, right? How do I get to Galveston and then? But okay, we'll evaluate it and take a look. But if you're interested, it's bsquadtravel.com. Take a look at that. That's very cool. For segment number three, let's talk about toward treatment free. This is Megan Milgrath. And her commentary was that she tried about 7 years ago the live and let die method. They went down the path to let bees self-select. In the end, however, she realized that it was a bad weed to let your bees die, as she stated. And her observation was, it was easy to see that her bees were dying. There was bad brood, there were bad bees, and other maladies that were just evident when you looked at the comb. Her commentary was that her bees were profoundly ill. And she not only keeps bees, but on her farm she has other animals. And in principle, animal welfare, they were not going to let their pigs and their goats and other things be unhealthy. So why should they do this same approach for the bees? And she had an aha moment where she crossed a threshold, it seems, and looked to find a different way. And that's what this talk was about. So in her description, she said you could go into a hive and see that it died. You could tilt the frames and look for signs that varroa were in there. You could look at the bees, you could look at the brood, and see evidence of deformed wing virus and other things going on. And as a beekeeper, the goal is to keep bees, not to kill bees and be a serial killer. And at the end of the day, she realized that they were losing too many colonies from varroa mites. And this live and let die method could work if you were willing to be isolated and take certain losses. But if you're in and amongst others, it's not going to work. And she explained why further into her talk. But the commentary is the live and let die approach treats bees like they're a disposal commodity. And that should not be what a beekeeper does. And when you go this approach, you could lose up to 95% of your bees, and they die profoundly ill, which is just not the way. This is me talking. Ow. Ugh. There's a lot of conversation out there to do this, and people with really good intentions are losing bees, and they don't have to. And she went to explaining that sometimes this will work and sometimes it won't. And it's a mix and a match of certain circumstances that allow it to take place and be successful in some areas and fail miserably in others. If you have bees that have the right genetics and you have different strains of deformed wing virus that are less virulent and you have no neighbors that are keeping mites alive and doing things that are bringing different genetics in. And let me make one point of this is when your bees die, what do? You replace them. Sometimes you replace them with your own, but sometimes your neighbors are buying new bees. And as they keep bringing things in, your ecosystem changes. You might survive for a while using splits of your own survivors, and then your neighbor who's losing bees buys packages from somewhere and brings in a strain of deformed wing virus that eventually pollutes what's going on in your area and takes your bees down because your bees were not dealing with that. And one of the principles is you're losing bees to varroa, but what you're really losing bees to is what the varroa brings into the field, right? What they're bringing from different strains of viruses that they carry. And new varroa being introduced from other places brings in the mix, and that's part of the problem that a person who's trying to be treatment-free could face. And they could go well for 2-3 years, and then all of a sudden everything collapses, and they're not sure why. So how do you do this then? How do you do the treatment-free thing? Well, her supposition was that you could get there by learning from what we did with tracheal mites and AFB and when varroa first came in. There were different approaches and different viewpoints on how you had to look at this. I said a moment ago, it's not about the varroa, it's about the vector-borne disease. In order for a pathogen to be transmitted, you have to have the virus and you have to have the vector. And of course, you have to have the host. So you can't eliminate the host here because then you don't keep bees. And the virus comes along with the vector. So the thing is, if you keep the varroa mite down, then the virus doesn't transmit And the recipe for success here is to keep the vector, meaning the varroa mite, down to a level where it doesn't transmit as much virus and the hive could stay healthy enough to survive. Couple that with the right genetics, the right nutrition, and some of the other factors that are required to make a hive survive, and you will get to treatment free. So one of her key points was the exponential growth of varroa mite in a hive multiplies the pathogen and the problems take off. And the strategy is to figure out how to get hives to compensate by keeping that varroa low. And some hives do this through hygienics. We know that queens are hygienic and they'll remove larva-affected. Wait, let me restate that. The queen and her genetics make the hive predisposed to be hygienic, meaning removing problem larvae out that have been impacted by varroa that are sick. You also have the ankle biter bees and other things that can help aid in getting rid of varroa. But if these bees are consistently being onslaught of varroa that they have to deal with, even the best bees that have the best hygienics and the best defensive grooming and other things are not going to survive because they're going to be under consistent assault. So this is going to be really difficult. As a treatment-free person, you're going to have to understand what's going on in all of your colonies. You're going to have to monitor and check for your mites. And the assessment here is which hives are dealing with the mites and which hives are not dealing with the mites. Now, in a treatment-free world, the ones that aren't dealing with the mites, eventually they're going to die. But when they die, their, let's just say, disease state is going to spread throughout. And again, when they die, you're going to replace them. And a lot of people bring new bees in and they start all over again. And the hive that sits over here that's doing the job you want is going to be overcome by the larger subset of neighbors who are not doing the job. So treat the ones, this is the secret, treat the ones that are not doing the job and keep them going, not dying outright. And eventually they'll be able to compensate and breed from the ones that are doing the job. And eventually you'll replace your apiary because those ones will die eventually, the ones that aren't doing the job. But you can make splits and grow your stock more and more from the ones that are surviving. And then those genetics are in your area. And if you and your neighbors in your contact area are doing the same thing, eventually the genetics in your space will solve the problem because you'll have hygienic bees that are grooming right and pulling out varroa and dealing with it. So the formula is treat the ones that are not working, let the ones that are working going, and make your splits from them. And the contrast for the other method was you used to let the other ones die. That's cruel. That's not a good plan. And when they die, we heard before, as I was saying, that the varroa transfer from them to any opportunistic host, and they're going over to the other hives, which can deal with theirs, but can't deal with everybody's. Or if they can deal with theirs and everybody else's, eventually some strain comes in and just overwhelms them. And then even treatment-free good hives go to waste. So her statement was, beekeeping will change 100% when you give varroa strategies the respect they deserve. And I think that's a great message for 2017. So Megan was speaking to a room full of beekeepers, some were brand new. And there were people asking about how do you monitor and this and that and so on. She didn't have time to explain, but her general guidance was, if you don't know what you're doing, and you have no practiced strategy from understanding and monitoring and knowing where your bees are in this world as far as their ability to cope, then doing something is important, and doing nothing is not an option. So you should monitor and consider treating in the spring and in the early summer. Don't wait till October until you get your program figured out in your apiary. So if you're new, that's reasonable guidance, right? We used to say treat in July and August. I think the answer now is you may have to treat earlier in the year. And this year, for the first time in my thing, and I know it's been said a couple years, and I've been like, I don't want to do it. But now I'm going to. I'm going to monitor my mites here right now, soon. So weather breaks, first time I go in the hive, I'm doing a mite check. And I'm really seriously considering doing some sort of mite treatment in the beginning before the brood gets capped all the way through, and I'm going to knock the mites down. And that way I start the season with a lower mite threshold, and as the bees ramp to full population, the mites will be farther behind than they would be if I didn't do anything. So in the long term, one of the things she said is bees are not going to improve by having more varroa. One of the aspects of treatment-free is I'm going to breed a better bee. And I've heard arguments on both sides of the evolutionary scale that actually bees can evolve very quickly, but actually bees are going to take time to evolve. And her analogy was she has a dog, and she had a picture of her dog driving a truck. It's sitting up, and it's got its paws up on the steering wheel. She said, no matter what I do, I'm not going to teach that dog how to drive the truck. It just doesn't have the capability to drive. It's not going to evolve to do that. No matter what how many times I put it in the truck, it's not going to do that. And the answer is, for bees, remember, we're working with bees that were brought over from Italy. Most of us have Italian stock. Apis cerana in Asia has learned to be simpatico with the mites, but our bees have not. And they're not going to evolve overnight. They may evolve quickly, but they're not going to have the skills to drive the truck. So just throwing them all together and thinking in a year or two it's going to solve itself is not going to happen. You could put a dog in a truck every day for a year. It's still not going to learn how to drive it. One of the other aspects she spoke, and I'm not going to belabor the point, is if you let the bees do what they're going to do, the ones that survive, are they going to be the ones that we want? I was reading last night about the German black bee, which is the original bee they brought into the United States. It wasn't a great honey producer. It was nasty. It was prone to swarm. But it was what they had back then. We don't use it anymore because it's not something you want to keep in your yard. If you allow the bees to self-select, you might end up with something that you don't want to use. I know that makes some people cringe, that notion, that nature should be allowed to run its course. However, if you are doing it the way that Megan is saying, where you're keeping your stock going, you're monitoring, you're figuring out which ones are surviving. And it's not just about monitoring mites to me. And I think her message was this way too. I won't put words in her mouth. You know your best colony. You know your favorite colony. You look across your yard, you have 10, 12, 20 hives, and you know which ones are producing. You know which ones are gentle, and they're not bleep bleep when you walk in and try to sting you as soon as you step into the yard. You know these things, right? So if it has good genetics and it's dealing with mites and it's a good producer, it's the type of bee you want to keep in your yard. If you left them sit out in the yard for whatever, and the ones that survived, you come back in 10 years and see who survived, you might not like what you find. So she's saying this method is actually more viable for you as a beekeeper to get the genetics in your area that you want. In short, it's basically just saying ask a bee to adapt to varroa is not likely possible. Not in the time frame we're giving it, and we're going to have to keep them going for a period of time while we find alternate strategies or just time elapses. And the good news is the report from Tom Seeley in the Arnott Forest, you may or may not have heard this, is that the bees that he checked, the feral stock up there, has somehow figured out how to get past this. So you're starting to see some natural recovery from this in time. Because if it always been here, wow, I think it came in 1986, if memory serves me right. So I was told after this talk in various circles that Megan wrote something that was either in Bee Culture or American Bee Journal on this. And I gave you the Cliff Note version of it. If you're interested, go check that out. I want to say it might have been in like the December version or November. And I'm sure that it can be found and you could read in more detail. And in her words, not mine, what she proposed, and evaluate it for yourself if you're interested. Pragmatically listening to this kind of gave me hope, set a new focus for me, but also depresses me. Because if you really want to do this treatment-free thing, you're going to have to be serious about monitoring and doing what you got to do. And it's going to require a ton of work. And it's an interesting thing to consider. And if you're going to do this, you probably need lots of hives to select, because you're certainly not going to look at two hives and figure out which one is going to be what. And who knows if one of them is even going to be a viable, good mite thing. You're going to be looking at dozen plus hives and picking two or three of them to carry forward if you're going to go this route. This is my thoughts on this. So it's an interesting notion. It makes you think. Now, one of the things that I would say as beekeepers, especially someone like myself in my situation, is I should be talking to my neighbors, all of them. And collectively, we're one big apiary, so we should be trying to do this in that format. And that's an interesting idea to me. Or if you could find a region to do this and take the hives that are surviving and split the stock amongst the survivors, amongst everyone, and genetically change the area of a region, which is similar to the approach that I had heard about Virginia and some of the things they were doing. So it was really interesting talk. I hope that I did it justice. I paraphrased a lot of different things that she talked about. She did it in an hour. I think I did it in 10 minutes. And I'm hoping I also carried the story arc the best way that she did, because she really did a great job at laying it out. Okay, let's move on to segment number four. Segment number four, this is Deb Delaney. Take Time to Smell the Roses was the name of her talk. It had nothing to do with Varroa. How about that? So what was really neat was she was talking about the strategy that flowers and plants employ to get pollinated. And her kind of subtle undertone was this was all about plant sex. So we know that in many locations, there's just problems in getting diverse pollen and nectar exposure for the bees. There's no food, there's poor food, monocrops, lots of corn and soybean. The landscape has changed. There's as much farming now as there was in past times, but the farms, their profile has changed, and we've talked about that a lot here on the program. But we'll go in a different direction here. What she was talking about is the importance of pollen and how the plants are trying to attract different pollinators. And from the plant's perspective, it's about reproduction, and not all visitors are equal. So coming in contact with the flower, the contact design of the plant takes into account how the pollinator transmits. So a bumblebee, for example, goes in and it gets pollen grains on its belly. So when it visits the next abdomen, sorry, when it visits the next plant, it's going to go in and the pollen transfer will be from the underside. So the plant will design itself that if it uses bumblebees, it will want to receive that pollen from the underside of the bumblebee. So thinking about a plant itself and who it wants to pollinate. Some plants take into account that they want a bumblebee because a bee packs the pollen in its pollen basket and takes it away. Not good for the plant. Counterproductive. A sweat bee takes it, but it never visits the female part of the plant. So bumblebee wins for the flower. It designs itself to accommodate bumblebees and not the others. So plants deploy different strategies to get different visitors. They might have bowl flowers where you could sit in and go around and gather the nectar and be exposed to the pollen. And it's wide open for that type of reward. It might be tubular flower shapes, so the pollinator has to enter and it's concealing the reward at the base, but while the pollinator is entering, it's getting pollen all over itself. Or maybe it's one of the pendant habit ones where it hangs, and think about a hummingbird coming in and flying. Something has to hover in order to get to whatever it is, one of those type of designs for a plant. And there's other aspects of design. Nectar spurs are features of a flower. They hold a lot of nectar and often presented to entice certain pollinators. Tubular flowers are designed with a petal or leaf that provides a ramp in. So you'll have this big tubular flower, and from underneath, you'll have one big petal that sits there, and it's the runway for the pollinator to land on so that it can then approach inside the flower. And then you have trumpet shapes and bell-shaped flowers, which present their pollen for back-type pollinators. Again, they're going inside and they're getting it on their back, their hairs, and other things. So a lot of plants change daily. And I don't know if people pay attention to that, but I have one really good example that has nothing to do with what Deb talked about. Is I could tell how cold it is by the rhododendron right outside the front door. When it's really, really cold, the leaves curl up and they go to a really small profile. But when it warms up, they open up and they become big and plump. It's amazing the change daily. You can go out and look at this plant and tell whether it's cold or hot by just looking at the rhododendron every day. So flowers do the same thing, surprisingly. Some open, some close. They change shape to the weather and external factors. And there's other functions of the flowers that accommodate whatever they're coming. Some only open in the morning. Some only open 1 week of the year. All of these things are strategies employed by the plant in order to get what they're looking for. So you can get even more detailed about this. If you look at pollination from the plant's perspective, there's a lot of strategies employed at the plant level because pollen is complex and an expensive plant component for the plant to produce. And what Deb went on to say is that it has several designs that let it serve in nature. And if you think about it, I never considered this, it has an oil layer for lubrication so it can move around, but it also protects the pollen from external forces. It has an exon layer, which is a durable outer shell. The size of the pollen grain is another factor and varies from plant to plant. And it's something that the plant does that defines what can carry it. Right? So that if a honeybee is coming, it can only carry certain size granules. The plant designs it to that so it can be packed on the corbicular. And that's designed for the honeybee, where a bumblebee might pass it up or it might be too heavy for something to carry. In the design of the pollen and the nectar, the color and odors are other attractants. So there's two ways this can go. Sometimes the odor is there to attract the insect, but sometimes the odor is saying, I don't want you, I want them. And certain bees learn to come, certain pollinators, certain butterflies learn to come to a specific plant because of the odor, where the other ones are repelled by it. So there was a bunch of different things that she went in further to talk about pollen composition and nectar composition. And sometimes pollinators are not polite to plants, and talked a little bit about that. They'll drill a hole in the bottom of a flower where the flower wants you to come in through the trumpet, but some drill a hole and then get to the nectar in nefarious ways, and they wreck the flower. So there's all kinds of things going on. And plants are always evolving for the problems that they're having. Even visitor problems, right, where there's not enough contact or there's light or no contact to transfer the materials from the pollinators, so they have to change their shape or design. So the good news is that nectar is the carbohydrate for the bees, and pollen is the protein, I should say, for the pollinators. So the plants always win because they have reasons to compel the pollinators to come. They just have to make sure they have the right form factor to accommodate their goals and their host goals. So again, Deb carried a lot of different topics throughout, more than I'm giving credit to, but interesting aspect to think about how the plants and the pollinators have this relationship. And you know, I've always known this, but she spelled it out in more detail than I'd ever considered, and it was an interesting topic. Really well done. So we see we're heading to an hour. I've got one more segment to go. We'll try and wrap this up in an hour and 15. Segment number 5, Samuel Ramsey. And I promise you, this is really a good one. It's like, but wait, there's more. The topic he had was varroa feed on honeybee blood and two other popular beekeeping myths. But to capture the essence of the moment, he relabeled it at the last moment two other alternative facts, given what was going on with Donald Trump at the time. So he started out with a varroa overview, saying it got discovered in 1987. In 10 years, it wiped out all the feral colonies, and they're everywhere in the world except for Australia. He went into a popular misconception, which is all publications, this is conjecture, it's not, he was stating as a fact, the hypothesis of varroa feeding on hemolymph, which is the equivalent of blood. A short little lesson here. Bees do not have a circulatory system like us with veins and arteries and things like that. The fluid that constitutes what would be the equivalent of blood in a human inside of a bee is just trapped inside the body itself, contained by the outer shell. And the fat layers that line the inside of the outer shell, and it's referred to as hemolymph. And so a lot of publications cite that varroa feed on hemolymph. And when traced back, it was not confirmed. It never has been confirmed. And there's a hypothesis as to how this happened. So it's easy to be confused as to how this could have occurred, if you think about it, because ticks, which are the closest cousin we can associate with to mites, feed on blood. So it's not hard to make the leap. The original assertion that varroa feed on blood or hemolymph was written in Cyrillic, and it came out of the early studies coming out of Russia. So most researchers, when reviewing what it was, could not understand what was written. Somewhere along the line, someone did a translation of it, and when they translated it, they got it wrong. And everybody continued to quote that wrong assertion. And all the time, up until this day that he gave this presentation, our assumption was that varroa feed on hemolymph. And it's an interesting thing because I've heard this quoted ever since I started in beekeeping. I've seen it in writing and have expressed this out to other people in these very podcasts itself, probably. So the question is, if he's saying that's not true, then what are they feeding on? Well, in order to understand that, he took a novel approach, which is, sorry for the squeamish, the excrement from the mite is not what it would be, and is not synonymous with things that feed on blood. It's a form of what he referred to as guanine and a very dried purine export. I think I've got those terms right. Don't kill me if I didn't. But the short of it is it a very low water content, and what's coming out of the mite and being deposited, and a lot of times if you want to know if you have a mite infestation after a hive dies, take a frame out, tilt it, look in the roof of the frame or somewhere in the cells, and you'll see these little white crystals. That's what we're talking about here. And so what he got to thinking about was a relative of his had gout, and it's a strange combination of things, but gout in humans have high guanine levels. And he somehow made that connection and thought, we should study this and figure out what it is the mites are working on because it doesn't make sense. But still, there's this little bit of a nagging thing about varroa being a close relation to ticks. And their mite lineage would lead you to believe that they should feed off of fluids. And of course, the mites insert their mouth parts, excrete digestive fluids, and suck up whatever is being digested by the acids or whatever it is they put into the bee. So if you think about it, mites should feed anywhere that they can vampire into the blood, or hemolymph is the proper term. But they always seem to be at a specific site. That was their observation. So they did this experiment where they put mites in a colony, and then they mapped every single time they found a mite where it was on the body and developed a heat map. Or at least they showed us a slide with a heat map. And every time they found the mite, they found that they had predominantly two areas. I'm being summary and level, but two areas where they found them. One was on the underside of the bee, up against a certain plate area, and the other was on top of the bee on its thorax up on the top. So the proper way to say this is they almost exclusively feed between the metasomal cernites, tergites, which are the plates on the bottom of the abdomen. And he showed, he went to a special lab where they froze the bee and the mite and then sliced it with a really sharp razor. And they showed these amazing imagery of where the mite is and how it tucked in and what was underneath the shell of the bee that the mite was actually tucking into. So you have to come back to where they found the mite. They found it on the underside, but they also found it on top. And the question is, why were they on top? Let's explain that part. And he did explain it. Most of the time you see the varroa, it's on top of the abdomen. This is a mite behavior that is called questing. He referred to it jokingly as the praise Jesus dance. I've seen this with a tick. You can go out in your yard if you have ticks, and believe me, in New Jersey we have plenty of them. And if you see a tick on a plant, it's got its forelegs up and it's looking to latch on to something walking past. Well, varroa mites do the same thing. They'll stand on top of the bee's thorax and put their legs up in what he called a praise Jesus moment, you know, swaying back and forth, and they'll hook on to a bee that's forager and take the next ride out if they want to get out of the hive or trade to another bee. He was the one that asserted, why do mites do this behavior? What are they leaving for? They want the next train out. The host, they can sense, they believe, that the host, meaning the bees, are sick and declining, and they don't go down with the ship. They hop on and go out to the next hive and take the forager out to the next colony where they can find their next meal and continue the species. So let me switch back to the mite preferences. Why are the mites on the underside of the abdomen? What they're finding is there's a denser floor of the fat body on the bottom of the bee. And varroa, it seems, are ingesting the fat body, which is the lipids and fats that are stored immediately underneath the bee. the mouth parts are only able to reach 15 to 20 micrometers into the host. And when they checked in between those sternites, I think they were called, they found that what's under there for a specific millimeter is always fat body. That's all the bee or the mite can get to in the bee. So now they've solved. Are they going after hemolymph? No. They're in that specific area and they're after fat body. So the question is, why? And how do you rule out that they're actually not after the hemolymph? To do so, they did a biostain experiment. They provided the bees with biomaterials, and based on the type of biomaterial, it shows up differently under light. Hemolymph shows up one color, fat shows up another color. So they did the biostain experiment, and then they ground up the mites, and depending on what they were feeding on, they would fluoresce in one way or another. So the fact of the matter is both fat body and hemolymph showed up when the mites were ground up, but far more were showing up with fat body. In fact, there was only a trace of hemolymph, but it had to be explained. So what they think happened there, and the reason that hemolymph did turn up in some of the mites and what they were eating, is that the bees that were used for the experiment were different ages. 62% was fat bodies, but the older bees developed more fat body and the percentage went up by 70% plus. So depending on the age, what the mite was getting to was either hemolymph or fat body, but when one was a different age versus another, they were getting different concoctions. So then the question is, why would the mite go after the fat body? What is it after there? So there's 9 essential functions in the bee's life. Growth and development are a factor in this. When a bee starts as an egg and it grows into a pupa and a larva and all of that, it has different organs at different times. And as the bee grows new organs, the old organs, I'll use the word, decompose, and they go down and become part of the fat body that ultimately becomes the adult bee. So everything that's needed to make a bee, when the bee starts pre-pupa, the creamy materials kind of dissolve in metamorphosis and transfer to the fat body and broken down pieces of those organs that the bee started its life with are replaced by adult growing organs, and it now becomes part of that fat body piece. So the way the bee does this is the bee intends to save that for resources for energy later. And it also, the value of the fat body plays a role in water loss. As the fat body exudes some waxes and oils to the skeletal part of the bee to keep it from drying out. Of course, just like humans, when you have insulation of fat, you tend to be warmer. So it's a thermoregulation aspect also that it lines the bee with and helps control temperature control for the bee. But another main component, if you know about fat bodies, is think about how bees overwinter. In the fall, they change and they store more fat body, and specifically a certain aspect of it is vitellogenin, which is an egg yolk-like precursor that the bee is using, and they live off these fat stores over winter when they don't eat. And you hear a lot of times people talking about bees in the fall change over their body chemistry in order to overwinter, and they're developing more fat body and vitellogenin to be able to last till spring. These proteins reduce oxidative stress and help them overwinter. So one other thing, and he was making a joke of why nature chose to do this, is the fat body is the immune system, part of the immune system of the bee. When a bee needs immunity, the fat body provides the antimicrobial functions. And when a bee is under attack from fungi or bacteria or other items, if the fat body is compromised, the bee is compromised. So there's all kinds of functions in this fat body layer that is inside of the bee underneath the shell. So they had some clues to start, so they had to go a little bit further in the study. So what they did was, they took a mite and they fed it only hemolymph, They fed it only Fat Body, and they fed it both, or as a control, they completely starved it, and they wanted to see what happens to the mite on these different differing diets. So in order to do this, they did this really novel thing, which he went into to explain how it was done, is they took a capsule, like one you would pop to get vitamin something, and they made a fake pupa out of it, and they put the products in it, and he talked about the labor-intensive way that they did this, but they basically made a fake pupa, and then they were able to spike it with the material of choice in order to get the mite to feed on just Hemolymph and just Fat Body to see whether or not it was going to go for one or the other and whether it could survive. And I'll cut to the chase and say that the bees that didn't get fed any, or the mites that didn't get fed anything, starved. The ones that were on Hemolymph, they lived for a while, but they ended up dying. But the ones that were on Fat Body, they survived the entire study. So 80% died when starved right away. 80% died by 2 days when they were only on Hemolymph. And all of the mites survived the entire study when fed Fat Body material. So there was one other amazing thing that occurred here. Researchers have never, ever been able to get a mite to lay an egg in a research experiment. And in this study, when feeding them out of these capsules with Fat Body material, a Varroa mite laid an egg. It was an amazing slide that he showed us, and he looked like he was beaming proud of the accomplishment. So bees, fake bees provided with this material, the mites fed on them, and they actually laid eggs. And there was one anomaly. One female feeding on the Hemolymph was able to create an egg. Now, what they think happened was, prior to it becoming part of the study, it was in a hive and it got some material, some Fat Body material, and by that, it was able to make the egg, and not because it fed on Hemolymph. But they had to make a footnote in the study. So, wow, cool. Dispelled the notion. And the million-dollar question is, well, what difference does this make, right? You know, I know of studies where people were trying to feed bees something that would end up in the Hemolymph, like thymol or derivatives, so that the mite would get that and it would impact the mite and the mite would not survive. Well, here you know the answer, that if you were trying to target the mite or the bee to have this in the Hemolymph, it would not have impacted the mite. But now, if they consider something that you could give to a bee, which would not make it sick and deter it, but somehow get stored in the fat, you may potentially be able to target the mite without harming the bee. How cool would that be? So he was really popular. He answered a billion questions after this, all kinds of people interested in what he's doing. And I have to say that this same talk, he gave it at the New Jersey Beekeepers 2-day symposium. He showed up on the second day to do it. And I watched the whole thing and was just as enthralled the second time he covered it. What an amazing presentation that was. I should also say that he came Saturday night and performed. Sang a bunch of songs with piano accompaniment. And I was there with my video camera and recorded it. And it was just amazing. Who knew? What a talented guy. So he's going to publish this data. It's not published yet. He's working with Dennis Van Engelsdorp, and this will be coming out, and you'll hear more about it. But we got a firsthand look at it. And what a neat study. What a great slide presentation, and a great presentation from him on laying it out. It was a fairly complex topic, and he put it out there really well. So look, if you don't go to these meetings, you're missing out, because they're just amazing. And with that, I'm going to say, I hope you enjoyed the recount. I hope you make it a point to get to some of these meetings at some time and get to see some of these speakers and researchers and support them. And would be remiss if I don't say something of thanks to the Philadelphia Beekeeper Symposium. What a great program they put on, and we really appreciate it. So thanks for listening, everybody. Be back soon with the next episode. And I'll leave you like I always do. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.